Our next case this morning is number 063848 and related numbers, the United States against Jackson, Shaw, and Young. Ms. Winslow.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Through mistakes and misconduct, Aina Shaw, Pamela Young, and Eddie Jackson were deprived of their right to a fair trial. They ask this court to reverse, to vacate the judgment below, and remand for a new trial. In this case, Your Honors, the government's entire case was built around a witness who never showed her face in the courtroom, never showed her face to the jury. Everyone agreed, and I think continues to agree, that Angela Hubbard was the leader of the more than $700,000 fraud against Washington Mutual Bank. After her fraud was discovered, as you know, and in an attempt to minimize her own criminal exposure, she met with the government, and she lied about who was involved in that theft of the money from Washington Mutual Bank. Despite these lies that became evident to the government at a certain point during this case, it continued to rely upon her statements. It continued to base its prosecution on the story that she told them originally, and it even presented some of her statements to the jury in the form of co-conspirator statements. When the defense attempted to impeach those statements, if you will, and to tell the jury the entire story, and that is that Angela Hubbard lied about who knew what and who was responsible for this fraud against Washington Mutual Bank.
Ms. Winslow, the recantation of Ms. Hubbard, wasn't that really only about the first transaction?
Yes and no. Ms. Hubbard was being prepared for her trial testimony, and she was being specifically asked about the first transaction. It's our understanding, and this is what was presented to the district court without any objection or without any objection from the government, that she was stopped in her statements prior to the other transactions being discussed. And that was a point that certainly the government could have raised on its redirect, and is certainly a point that the defense would have acknowledged, that she didn't get to the second and third transactions.
But wouldn't any error here be harmless, given the money trail implicating all of the defendants, and particularly given that the charge most relevant to the recantation was dropped?
The charge most relevant to the recantation was dropped, Your Honor, but this is a scheme. The government charged an ongoing scheme. And by its own theory of the case, these individuals were involved, with specifics, Angela Hubbard and Aina Shaw were involved throughout. That was the government's theory of the case. But more importantly, and this ties into the other issues stated in the briefs, the government had no evidence of knowledge. In fact, the only inference that the government asked for the jury to draw regarding knowledge was as to this money trail and as to the relationship between Angela Hubbard and the remaining three trial defendants, Ms. Shaw, Ms. Young, and Mr. Jackson. And by asking the jury to infer that the close relationship between these parties suggested knowledge on the part of the trial defendants, the fact that Angela Hubbard was willing to falsely accuse and outright lie about the involvement of one of those defendants is directly relevant and cannot be harmless.
But if that recantation was admitted, then for the sake of completeness, the government probably could have introduced the further statements that Shaw and Hubbard discussed the success of the Young transfer, and that Shaw had indicated her desire to get some money that way as well. I mean, it could have been far worse for
I think that there's an argument under completeness, but that it's counteracted by the defendant's rights under the Confrontation Clause. That clearly falls within the Crawford versus Washington decision. And even, Your Honor, even hypothetically, if it didn't, and if we didn't prevail in that objection, the defense was prepared to deal with that response. And because there were additional questions that we could have asked to put that in a frame of context that wouldn't have been as damaging. But the district court in this case didn't reach the correct legal standards even for determining whether this recantation, for lack of a more complete phrase, whether this recantation were admissible. Rather than looking to the requirements of the federal rules of evidence and rather than looking at the standard for corroboration that has been set out by this court in United States versus Najib, the court simply made its own credibility determination, which is troubling for a number of reasons. In this case, Judge Castillo stated that he could, and I quote, not in good conscience admit any of her out-of-court statements. And that was the judge's ruling, or the judge's summation of his ruling on this regard. But he did. In fact, the co-conspirator statements that were admitted through another one of the government's witnesses, that most specifically, Aines did it. That is an out-of-court statement by the same witness that the district court found too unreliable to allow any statements on behalf of the defense. Again, troubling that the district court didn't see fit to consider the standards set out under the federal rules of evidence or the very specific and, frankly, pretty simple three-part test set out by this court in the 1995 case, Najib. Had the court looked at those three considerations, relationship between the parties, whether or not the declarant had been advised of her Miranda rights, and whether or not the statement was made in an attempt to curry favor with the authorities, it would be clear that this is the type of statement that is sufficiently corroborated that, although exculpatory to the trial defendant, it is inculpatory or against the penal interest of the declarant and should be admissible under the federal rules of evidence.
Ms. Winslow, what were the corroborating circumstances that would clearly indicate that her recantation was trustworthy?
As I indicated, this was a statement that was made during the trial preparations for Ms. Hubbard. Ms. Hubbard was to be the government's key witness at the trial. She had been long Mirandized. She was, in fact, had appointed counsel, and appointed counsel was present. She had met with the government on a number of occasions and was well aware that her plea deal, the beneficial plea agreement that she had already entered, was jeopardized by her statements that undermined her previous statements. She was advised of all of these factors, again, in the presence of counsel, and continued to state her recantation. Given those circumstances, in addition, there was no close relationship between Ms. Hubbard and Ms. Shaw, for whom the individual who most benefited from this recantation. They knew each other through their employment at Washington Mutual Bank. You could call them work friends. They didn't have a long-standing relationship of any familial or other kind. And clearly, I think without question, and the government really hasn't disputed this, the statement was not made in an attempt to curry favor with the authorities. I think it's fair to say the authorities did not view the statement favorably at all, as shown by the fact that the government withdrew her plea agreement shortly thereafter. In United States versus Peek, this court made clear that the trial court's determination of the credibility of the out-of-court declarant is not the relevant issue. The relevant issue is whether the standards for corroboration are met and whether this is a statement against penal interest and the declarant is unavailable.
Wasn't the Peek case, didn't that involve a state of mind exception, 8033?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that treated a little differently than this 804 provision?
804B3, it did have to do with the state of mind exception, Your Honor, but I think that the analysis applies equally here. There's nothing in any case law I found to indicate otherwise. And I think particularly here, where this court has gone to some lengths to set out the standards for corroboration, to discuss the considerations, the appropriate considerations for the trial judge, and never has it said a determination of the credibility of the out-of-court declarant should be controlling. That's an issue for the jury, and that's, as we discussed in the opening briefs in this case, the jury should have been the body to make a determination about credibility. Certainly, the government had the benefit of the out-of-court statements that were incriminating, without the defense having the benefit of balancing the jury's view by telling them all of the statements that Ms. Hubbard had made.
But doesn't 804B3 require the judge to make some assessment on the admissibility of that type of evidence?
It does, Your Honor, and the assessment that it's required to make is whether there's sufficient corroboration, which is why I return again and again to Najib, which is the most thorough discussion of this, of what determination need be made. And Najib makes no mention of a finding of credibility. In fact, it was an issue that was raised by the parties, and this court set out a very clear three-part balancing test to determine whether there's sufficient corroboration. Simply because Ms. Hubbard, and I think we can all agree, Ms. Hubbard certainly is not the most credible witness. She is orchestrated a $700,000 fraud, lied about it on a number of occasions. Those were all factors that could be used by the jury in assessing her credibility. But they should have known the whole story.
Well, given the large amounts of money suddenly acquired by these defendants and their apparent failure to determine the source or otherwise inform the bank that it didn't belong to them, you know, when you talk about a jury, why couldn't the jury find that they, that these people knew it was criminally derived?
Your Honor, this is a case in which the government had no evidence whatsoever as to knowledge, no evidence whatsoever as to what these defendants were told about where this money came from. And in light of the fact that Angela Hubbard is the type of individual who's willing to lie, who's willing to tell false stories to her own benefit, it's not unreasonable. I don't think it's paranoid speculation, as we said in the brief. I don't think it's paranoid speculation to suggest that she could have lied to these defendants about where that money came from and what it was for. And the government, I think, added to this point in its closing argument, which I'd like to touch on very briefly, when it shifted the burden to the defendants by saying, I don't recall hearing from Ms. Winslow, myself, I don't recall hearing from the defense any explanation about where this money came from. The jury didn't hear an explanation from the government either, and it is the government's burden and not the burden of the defense to present that evidence. In light of the lack of evidence and in light of the other possibilities of where this money could have come from and what the defendants could have believed about the source of that money, the evidence that Angela Hubbard lied about the involvement of other defendants was essential to the defense for all three defendants. If you have no other questions, I'll reserve my time.
Thank you, Ms. Winslow. We'll hear now from Mr. Hodling.
May it please the Court, my name is Chris Hotelling, and I represent the United States in this appeal. I'd like to turn first to the primary issue which was raised in the brief, and that is the 804B3 argument. First and foremost, this issue and this whole line of questioning was simply not relevant to an issue that was joined at trial. The statements that the defense wished to elicit during the course of the cross-examination of the case agent dealt with alleged misrepresentations by Ms. Hubbard regarding Defendant Shaw's participation in the very first wire transaction, the Pamela Young January 29, 2003 transaction. Ms. Hubbard said that Ms. Shaw wasn't involved in that. The government took that on its face, dismissed the count as to Ms. Shaw, and then when the indictment was superseded a few weeks later, Ms. Shaw was not alleged to be a participant in that first transaction. So the whole idea that this line of questioning would have been sufficient to properly cross-examine Bruce Jones, one of the co-defendants, simply doesn't hold water, given that it just simply wasn't relevant to what Ms. Shaw was on trial for in this case. I would like to talk for a moment about the assertion about the role that played with the co-conspirator statement and Ms. Winslow's representation that essentially the government's case relied heavily on this co-conspirator statement. That's simply not true. What the government's evidence was based on documentary evidence phone records, as well as information provided by Washington Mutual officials that directly tied each of these defendants to this charged fraud. With respect to Ms. Shaw, the evidence shows that she received substantial sums of money from her co-defendant, Angela Hubbard, shows that she received directly from Bruce Jones following the April 29th transaction, a $60,000 check from Bruce Jones, a man that she didn't know, and also the fact that her digital identification number was used to reverse the subject wires on Washington Mutual's computer system. So I think for the defense to somehow suggest that that the co-conspirator statement of Bruce Jones' statement that Ioannis did it was a key piece of evidence, I believe disregards the total volume of evidence that the government presented at trial. And specifically then addressing also Mr. Jones' statements and his statements regarding that Ioannis did it, I think is independently corroborated also by the evidence that I just talked about. The fact that, again, Mr. Jones wrote a check following the infusion of $187,000 into his account, that he then turned around the very next day and cut the check, split that money into three essentially equal portions, himself keeping a third, Angela Hubbard getting a third, and then Ioannis Shaw also getting a third, a woman that Mr. Jones testified he'd never met, never spoken to. So I think that it's unfair to truly characterize these co-conspirator statements as kind of a linchpin to the government's case, and that also when you factor that in, I think it becomes clear that this line of potential questioning certainly didn't rise to the level of expediency that Ms. Winslow seems to suggest that it did. It was a relatively minor point in the government's proof that was substantially corroborated by physical evidence and testimonial evidence provided by individuals at Washington Mutual.
That last wire transfer out of Washington Mutual, $187,000.
Correct.
Wasn't that authorized, and didn't that get issued after Hubbard was already gone from the bank?
I didn't mean to cut you off, and you're absolutely correct.
And wasn't Shaw still at the bank at that time?
Shaw was still at the bank. Angela Hubbard had actually left the day prior. And so on April 28th, she left the employment of Washington Mutual. That's Angela Hubbard. April 29th, Ioannis Shaw was still an employee at Washington Mutual. The money went out from Washington Mutual on that day, and we were able to tie definitively Ms. Shaw to that wire transfer because her user identification number was used to reverse the wire.
And wasn't the signature, authorized signature on that wire the same as on the very first transaction?
On the wire transfer worksheets?
Right.
Actually, the signature portion, because it's the government's contention at trial that those authorization signatures were cut and paste from legitimate ones. Actually, the cut and paste portion on the Jones wire matched the cut and paste that was done on the Yvette Hewlett wire that was on May 8th, approximately 2 weeks later. The government's position is that Ms. Shaw made that cut and paste job on the Jones one and then subsequently reused it down a couple of weeks later when the $345,000 wire transfer went to Yvette Hewlett. So there was the signatures of Stan Zotis was contained on both the Bruce Jones wire and the Yvette Hewlett wire, and Stan Zotis had left the employment of Washington Mutual prior to both of those wire transfers. I'd like to turn now and address the allegation or the assertion by the defense that Judge Castillo somehow, usurped the role of the jury by making a credibility determination as part of its initial determination as to the admissibility of this evidence under 804b3. And Judge Tinder, I believe that you made this point accurately, that the judge has a responsibility as a gatekeeper in the role in the introduction of evidence to make a determination as to whether or not certain proffered evidence is admissible during cross-examination or at any point in time when it might be presented to the jury. That's exactly what he did in this case. 804b3 has certain set requirements that this court has outlined in terms of whether or not such a statement is admissible. In this case, the key issue was whether or not there were sufficient corroborating circumstances of trustworthiness. And as Your Honor indicated, the judge has an obligation before allowing that to come in to make a determination that the proponent of the statement has met that particular burden. So in this case, it's not the judge usurping the jury's role as a determiner of credibility, but it was rather, in this instance, under this particular rule, the judge's obligation to ensure that the three prongs were met. And I think that's what takes this particular case out of the case in Peek, where, again, it was the state of mind exception, which doesn't contain an express requirement for admissibility that there be a finding of sufficiently corroborating circumstances of trustworthiness. And I think that in this role, the judge acted on all fours. He knew what his responsibility was. He read the briefs. He entertained arguments from the counsel. He read the cases, and he made a determination that the statement was simply unreliable. And I'm not sure we can fault Judge Castillo for doing that. This is a situation where the defense wanted to essentially introduce the fact that Angela Hubbard lied, an inherently unreliable statement. Unlike any of the circumstances that we have in the cited cases, it's clearly unlike what was present in Naguib, where the witness got up on the stand and admitted in his plea agreement that Mr. Naguib actually was not involved or minimized his knowledge as to his particular role in that offense and was clearly relevant to the defense. In this case, it's a lie. That's the bottom line. The defense wanted to elicit facts about a lie. And on those facts, it simply was unreliable. It was not something that the court could credit, especially when Angela Hubbard lied to him in the context of an under oath entry of a guilty plea. So I think that on that point that the judge was eminently reasonable. I want to touch on a quick point too that Ms. Winslow raised in her argument regarding what the defense would have done if, and I think this goes to the questions that you were asking, Judge Rovner, if the judge had allowed this. It's the government's position that we would have had every right to have introduced those other inculpatory statements regarding Ms. Shaw's conversations with Ms. Hubbard both before the Pamela Young January transaction and after. And that under those circumstances, the doctrine of completeness, as well as just an independent basis of admissibility, that they were also statements against penal interest for the same reason that the exculpatory ones were going to be admissible, the government would have been able to introduce those to provide context for the statement. Now, Ms. Winslow seemed to suggest that the defendants were in a position to deal with the potential confrontation clause problems that would have arisen from the government's attempt to bring those additional statements in. I'm not sure that that's belied by the record, simply by the fact that counsel for Ms. Young objected to this line of questioning. He didn't want Ms. Winslow to be able to introduce this line of questioning through the witness. In fact, it's clear we cite the record citation in our brief, but I believe that this was a hot-button issue that the other defendants wanted to stay away from. I believe Judge Castillo appropriately recognized the potential problems here and made the appropriate determination that it wasn't admissible. Turning briefly now to some of the sufficiency arguments that Ms. Winslow, unless there are some questions about...
Yeah, I have a question about closing argument.
Yes.
Because in your brief you argued that the remark in closing argument was a reference to Shaw's attorney, not to Shaw.
That's the government's position, correct?
Right. But given that Shaw's attorney could not have testified to supply an explanation for the money, wasn't there at least a significant danger here that the jury would assume that the reference was to Shaw?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that the government, in its rebuttal, was attempting to again bring it back to what the evidence in this case was, and again, it's the significant documentary evidence that was presented, and specifically the fact that Ms. Shaw received $60,000 from Mr. Jones, a man that she had never met. And that was a significant portion of the government's opening closing summation. It was a fact that was, I would imagine, it was strategically decided to somewhat minimize the impact of that $60,000 kickback check. And it was simply an effort on the part of the government to bring the jury back around.
So, forgive me, but is it the government's position that there was absolutely nothing improper about the statement, drawing attention, or that it drew attention to the jury of the fact that there was a failure to testify here?
The government
doesn't see any problem here?
The government did not in any way attempt to comment on the defendant's decision not to testify. It was a comment that was specifically elicited to discuss key pieces of evidence. Evidence that was presented during the course of the trial, evidence that was key to the government's assessment of what had been presented, and it was in no way intended to touch on, infringe on, or even remotely discuss the defendant's decision not to testify. Going quickly to the sufficiency arguments, the government has laid it out pretty explicitly in its brief. And counter to what Ms. Winslow's representation, there was substantial amount of evidence of knowledge and intent on these defendants' parts that they were aware of and participants in this scheme to defraud. Now, Ms. Winslow characterizes it as direct evidence, and that we don't know what certain facts were made or certain statements made to the defendants would suggest what they knew or what they did not know. Well, Judge, this court is aware, and this court has repeatedly mentioned that oftentimes in fraud cases, it's difficult to have direct evidence of knowledge, and instead, what's important is to establish it through circumstantial evidence, and that's exactly what the government did in this case. With respect to all of the defendants, Ms. Young, she was the sister of Angela Hubbard. She lived in Texas. She had no banking relationship with Washington Mutual. She had a relatively low balances in her account. And then one day, $197,000 is transferred into her account. And the very next day, she writes a check for $97,000, approximately half of it, to her sister at Washington Mutual. Certainly, very strong circumstantial proof of knowledge. She then transferred some of that money into a brand new account that she opened the very next day, and essentially, that's what happened there. With Eddie Jackson, very similar circumstances. Friend of Angela Hubbard, another individual whose bank accounts, I see that my time is expiring. I'll just conclude it there. The government respectfully asks that the convictions of the defendants be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Winslow have? Thank you.
Briefly on two points, beginning with the issue of the closing argument. The government has stated that it intended no way to comment on the failure or the decision by the defendants not to testify. But in asking the jury to consider that they had heard no explanation from myself or from my client, really, it necessarily pointed directly to the decision not to testify. If I had, during my closing argument, offered such an explanation, with my client having not taken the stand, certainly there would have been an objection, and rightfully so, that my statements were presenting evidence that was not taken in testimony. Returning to the question of the relevance of Ms. Hubbard's false statements, her recantation, the government touched on another aspect of the relevance specifically to Ms. Shaw, and that is that there was a substantial amount of what the government considered to be 404B evidence, including some unsent wires that were intended to benefit George Davis, my client, Ms. Shaw's husband, and other transactions that it alleged Ms. Shaw was responsible for. The basis for these allegations were, in fact, the unsent wires themselves, just the sheets of paper that were found in and around Washington Mutual Bank after these transactions were completed. It has been Ms. Shaw's position from the beginning during trial and still that she was not responsible for those wires and that they were, in fact, placed in order to make it look as if she was responsible for those. And again, as we addressed in the rebuttal briefs, that sounds a lot like paranoid speculation unless you know, unless the jury knows, that there was an individual who was falsely accusing Ms. Shaw of being involved in this fraud and then later finally admitted that those accusations were false. There's no other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.